Thank you, Kay. I am Sybil Daugherty, and I am a member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. And as soon as God takes my heart out of my throat and puts it back down in my chest, I'm going to be okay. I get all these things in place, and the butterflies out of my stomach and up on my shoulders, and I'll be all right. I didn't know who Kay was talking about when she started saying all those things. I'm so glad to be here. My husband gave me a lot of encouragement this morning. He said that one thing for sure, I was going to be the best Al-Anon speaker here this weekend. I didn't really know I was the only one, and that's when it dawned on me. I am so grateful to be here. We've really enjoyed this weekend. We've never been to Mont Eagle before. This is our first time. And I thank all the board members for having the confidence in us to ask us to come. I'm just like everybody else, and I'm up here to tell you what it was like for me and what happened and what I'm like today. I was born and raised, like everybody, and all of that occurred up in northwest Arkansas in a little town called Fayetteville. Now, I didn't grow up there until about the sixth grade. My father was always changing jobs, and I resented that a great deal because I had to be the new kid in school all the time. I remember going to school up until about the sixth grade in Fayetteville, and then we started moving around. And from then all the way through the 12th grade, I was the new kid on the block every year. But I know today that he was always bettering himself. He did that a lot in each move that we made. He made a better deal, and he got a better job. And raising four kids was not easy back in those days. I do have an older sister. She's 18 months older than I am, and two younger brothers. And I am not the child of, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. There was never even any alcohol in my home. I don't know anything about drinking. I didn't know anything about drinking. My sister is about a head taller than I am. She has blonde hair and blue-green eyes. She made straight A's all through school, and she married the perfect son-in-law, and I brought home the alcoholic. And I compared myself to her growing up, and I don't think my parents ever said to me, "You're not as good as Barbara," or "You didn't do that as well as Barbara does," but I heard that somewhere. I never thought that I could quite measure up to her, and I carried this throughout my entire life, I think. I am still somewhat insecure. I don't know where Peg is this morning, but I brought two outfits to wear because I didn't know what to wear, and I couldn't make up my mind, and I thought, well, I'll wait and see what the other speakers wear, and then she showed up in that sparkly little number last night, so I opted for my little gray suit. And besides that, my sponsor is Joanne from Memphis, and some of you know her, and she wasn't here to tell me which one to wear, and I just wore my little gray suit. So I do want her to know that I remembered to put my makeup on and my blush and my lipstick, and I even have some eyeshadow and mascara, so she'd be proud. She's always saying, "Put some blush on, you look so washed out." And I love her, and I miss her this weekend. She was to come with us, and she got sick at the last minute. I broke my train of thought, but I think I was just growing up. I have a brother that's in the AA program today. He has about 9 months on my husband. And sometimes I forget to talk about him. You see, I thought he was just no good and a crazy SOB, and he didn't belong in AA because I tried to get my husband in here for a real long time, and I was not responsible for my brother. It wasn't my fault that he was my brother. I didn't choose him, and I did choose my husband, and I didn't want to be wrong about what I had chosen. So I'm very proud of my brother today, and I'm proud that he has found sobriety. Growing up, we had, my youngest brother was very ill. He was born with a kidney deformity, and he was in Barnes Children's Hospital in St. Louis and also in Mayo's Clinic. And the rest of us, the three of us, had to be absolutely dead before they took us to the doctor because, I mean, you know, hospital and doctor bills were just outrageous even back then. And I remember being farmed out to one of my grandmothers when my brother had to go to the hospital. And my parents grew up in Oklahoma. My mother's Indian and my grandmother's three-quarters Cherokee. And she's 92 years old, be 93 in February. And we loved to go to her house. Now, my other grandmother was a little strict, straight-laced Southern Baptist lady that said you were going to hell if you wore short shorts and went to the movies, and we didn't want to go stay with her. And up in northwest Arkansas, they raise a lot of chickens. If you ever drive down the highway up there, you'll realize that because you can't get away from it. And they lived just over in Oklahoma across the state line, and they raised chickens. So we had to go to the chicken farm when my brother was in the hospital. And my favorite thing to do was, I don't know, I wasn't raised on a farm, but being out there a lot, I knew they had to cull out the little runts, and the chickens are really dumb, and they run over each other, and the ones that are sickly, they pick on them, and they would cull out those, and I would take care of them and build a little pen for them, and they all had names, and I fed them all summer and all the time I was there. So being a caretaker, I guess, was just a natural thing for me. And I knew, because my grandmother had told me, that when I left, she had to kill those that were not well, and she couldn't take them to market. She couldn't raise them, and it cost too much to keep them. And, of course, I would take care of them and dream that they were going to live a full, happy life, knowing that they were going to die as soon as I left there. But I guess I became a caretaker at a real young age. As I said, we moved around a lot, and I was always insecure no matter where we went. I didn't like being the new person on the block, and I didn't like being the new girl in school. And I've heard the alcoholics say so many times that they felt out of place and not quite a part of anything. And I know what that feeling is like, and I've learned in this program that Al-Anon and AAs are so much alike. We really are. I never felt if I could be whatever you wanted me to be. If I was with the good girls, I was just as good. And if I was with the others, I'd drink a beer and smoke a cigarette. Whatever you were doing, that's what I was going to do too, so I would fit in. I didn't date a whole lot. In high school, they used to call me Ann Landers. The boys would come and ask me, why doesn't so-and-so like me? I'm just crazy about her. And I'd try to fix them up, you know. And there again, I was a caretaker. I was taking care of all of them. I wanted everybody to be happy. In my senior year in high school, we had a young man who, there were three of us girls that ran around together, one redhead, one blonde, and myself. And they used to call us the Three Musketeers. And the blonde girl dated a boy who was, his nickname was Tiny, if that's any clue. He was on the football team, and he was a huge guy. And we loved him to death. And just before graduation, he was drinking a little and celebrating graduation, and he swung off a grapevine into the Arkansas River and made a dive when it broke, and the water was only about knee deep. And he broke his back and his neck, and he's paralyzed to this day. He's a quadriplegic. But the night of the senior prom, I did not go to the senior prom. His girlfriend went. He got a date for her, and she went to the senior prom. I went out to the hospital and stayed with Tiny because I didn't want him to be by himself. So I'm telling you all of this so that you'll know how well I fit in with this alcoholic of mine. I always love to take care of people. We moved to Memphis, Tennessee, when I was like a junior in high school. My daddy went to work for Edsel Division of Ford Motor Company. And I hated the high school. It was the largest school I'd ever been to in my entire life. And I spent a lot of my lunch hour in the ladies' room, in the girls' bathroom. None of us kids liked it in Memphis. It was just so big. And I wanted to go back to Fayetteville. And Toward the latter part of my junior year, of course, it became evident at the factory level that Edsel wasn't going to be such a hot seller. So my daddy took his old job back with the Lincoln Mercury dealership in Fayetteville, and I moved back to Fayetteville to get to graduate there with all my friends. And it was so important to me, and I loved it. But soon after that, Daddy was rehired with the Lincoln Mercury division of Ford, so we went back to Memphis. I didn't have any friends there. I had just graduated from high school, and they moved me back to that big, big town. And I tried to be in contact with some of the girls that I'd met when I was a junior there at Central High School, but I just didn't quite make it. My parents, I had always dreamed of going to the University of Arkansas, and so we moved to Memphis, and mother took me out to Memphis State to enroll me, and I showed them both. I went to work. I got me a job, and I didn't go to the university at all. I didn't go to college. I went to work at Plow Incorporated in Memphis, and since I didn't know anyone there, and I hadn't graduated from high school there, one of my little brothers, my youngest brother, had met a little boy that he was running around with, and he asked me to take him over to his house one day, and I did, and he introduced me to his sister, and she was my age. She had just graduated too, and she was working and had a new car, and I started to run around with her. Shortly after we moved to Memphis, I need to tell you this, we did always join a church as soon as we made a move, and we joined the church, and this young man who was like their youth director started asking me out, and I started dating him. And he was the kind of boy that if he said he would be at my house at 7:30, he was there at 7:25. If he said that he would take me downtown to the Peabody to dinner, he took me the very next date we had. And I went to Little Rock to visit friends one time, and when I opened my suitcase, there was a little gold bracelet wrapped up for me in there. He had given it to my mother and asked her to put it in my suitcase so that I would be surprised when I arrived there. And when he started talking about marriage and what kind of diamond rings I liked, I knew that I did not want to marry him because, you see, he was dull, he was dependable, he was normal. And, you know, there was no excitement. I know that today. I didn't know it then. I didn't know why I didn't love him or didn't want to chase after him. But I think that's why, because he was so normal. When I met this girl, we started running around together, and in Memphis, we would go, back in those days, we would get in her car and go up and down Summer Avenue from one little drive-in to the other, and we were looking for boys is what we were doing at night, and, you know, we had to eat something and drink a Coke at every drive-in we pulled in. And one night I met this boy down there, and she knew some of his friends, and I don't know, I had met him, and I'd never seen him before. And they said, oh, well, he'd been away at college. He was going to Mississippi State. They told me he was a basketball player. And so anyway, we went to a party, she and I, together, and someone asked to take her home, and he asked if he could take me home. And I guess that's why we went to the party anyway, was to find somebody. So he took me home, and he said, if I called you and asked you out sometime, would you go out with me? And of course I said, well, I'll give you my phone number, and why don't you call me sometime and find out? So he did call me. And I was soon to learn that he had never gone to college. He married in high school and was getting a divorce from his wife. And he told me all about her and how horrible she was. And she'd taken all of his money, and he didn't even have enough money to buy any beer. And I said, well, honey, I'll buy you all the beer you want. And, you know, my only way of identifying with that was that if I bought a six-pack of Coke, you know, that would last me all night long, and I might even have one or two left for the next day. So I thought a six-pack of beer is all that anybody could drink. And I did buy beer for him, and I was really impressed with how much he could drink. I don't know why it impressed me, but, you know, I'd just never been around anybody that drank. I am told that my father drank as a young man, but I never saw him drink. He was an only child, and I think he tried not to be such a sissy because his mother tried to make him a sissy, and he drank and he did a few wild things, but that was long before I could ever remember. And so I never knew anybody that drank. Now, I did know that growing up, my brother, the one that's one of us, when he was about 13, we were moving again, and when we went in his bedroom to move the bed, there were malt liquor cans under his bed. Now, wasn't that stupid? He wasn't very smart. But anyway, they were under his bed, and my daddy was brought up to, as I said, he was an only child, and he did not spare the rod. But he never spanked my sister and I. But he did spank those boys, and he spanked them hard. And he was not just spanking my brother. He was wailing the daylights out of him. And I was only probably a junior in high school, and I stepped between he and my brother, and I said, if you hit him one more time, he and I will leave this house, and we'll never come back. So there again, I had somebody to take care of. And that I lied to my daddy for my brother over and over and over again. But that's the only experience that I'd ever had with anybody drinking. And of course, my brother was 4 years younger than me, and so we didn't run around. And I didn't know how he acted when he drank. But I thought that this boy that I met, when he drank all that beer, you know, he wasn't even drunk. He was more fun. Gosh, we had more fun. He was just the life of the party. I mean, I never had been to a bar before. He took me to my first bar, and I wasn't even old enough. In Tennessee then, I think you had to be 21, and I had to borrow an ID from somebody to get in, and boy, it was lots of fun. I loved it, and we had a lot of good times. We married probably 6 months after we'd met, and I thought he never would ask me. It was a long courtship, but I could see that he needed me to take care of him. He just had so many problems. He had a lot of bills from this marriage that he'd gotten out of, and I could help him take care of that, and I started paying his bills before we got married. I mean, you know, isn't that the least you could do is help him? I knew that he wouldn't be like that when we married, and things got worse. One night, one of his friends knocked on the door, and I went to the door, and I said, I'm sorry, Bob is out. And he said, yeah, I know he is, in the back seat of my car. Would you come get him? And that's kind of the way our life went. And I became, it was my fault. I knew it was. There had to be something I could do to get him to stay home and not drink like he was drinking. And he would tell me over and over and over again, you know, that he wouldn't do it anymore, and I believed him, and I think he meant it. Back then, I know today that he meant it. Seems like he always intended to come home, and he never made it. And we played all those games that I know so many of you are familiar with. I heard Nell and I say one time that it was almost like her mouth was attached to the door. The door would open and her mouth would fly open, and that's the way I was. Where have you been? How much did you have to drink? And he'd always say a couple. Now, a lot of them said two, but his was just a couple, just a couple. And we would go from room to room, me following him, and he would say, now, I don't want to argue, and I'd say, I guess by God you don't. And we'd get it on, you know, and it was my fault. Today, he has some scars. I don't. He has some scars on his body. I wasn't real good, but I could throw things. And he was laying in bed this morning. He doesn't know that I thought about that, but laying on his side up there, and I had a can of hairspray in my hand, and I threw it at him back then. And when I saw him in the bed this morning laying like that, I thought about it and I laughed, but it sailed right over his rear end and hit him right between the eyes. And I meant to hit him in the rear end. Now, you know, nobody would ever believe I meant to hit him in the butt, and it hit him between the eyes. But it was the way he was laying in bed. I know one morning he woke up and couldn't get his eyes open because he had two gold earrings, one on each eye, and they were not mine. I had never seen them. I had placed them there so that he would know that I found them. He said that I should have been a member of the FBI. And I remember he used to tell me that. But I did a lot of daddy hunting and rescuing. I rescued him a lot. And the first time I was asked to talk in front of AAs, it absolutely scared me to death. It was at a place in Memphis called the Action Club, and I'd spoken to some Al-Anons, you know, and that was okay. But I thought, God, I can't talk in front of those AAs. And I happened to remember how I used to storm in the bar and grab him by the hair of the head and pour beer over her. And I caused a lot of chaos, and I used a lot of words that even a sailor would have been proud of. And I thought, you know, some of you could have been sitting in that bar, and you could have seen me like I used to be. And I'm so much better today. Why not get up here and share this with you, what has happened to me? And I don't have to be that way anymore. I went in a bar one time, and he was sitting there. I think we had a two-week-old baby at home, I asked him if he was ready to come home. He said no. And back then, all the beer bottles were glass. The ashtrays were glass. And I sat down in the booth with him, and they'd been eating and drinking and everything. And I just took my hand and just swiped it all off in the floor. And everything broke and just in 1,000 pieces. And everybody in there stopped. And you could have heard a pin drop in there. And he said, "Let's get out of here. You're embarrassing the hell out of me." Well, you know, that's the way I was. And we had two little boys, 4 years apart, and he had two children by a previous marriage. And I've had to work through some resentments with those stepchildren. He used to go get them for the weekend and leave as soon as he brought them in on Friday night, and we didn't see him again till Sunday afternoon. And that was not those kids' fault, but I think I took it out on them. And I resented them. And they spent every summer with us. As soon as school was out, they came and spent the summer with us. And when school started, we shipped them back home. And, you know, I resented those kids and I resented her. And it was not her fault. And today, all of those kids are grown. His two children in adulthood have told me that I did a good job. And I know I didn't. But they said that at least they knew that I'd always be there. And so we're working through a lot of things like that. I love those kids today. Our other two children are, Bob and I have two boys. And we've had a lot of good times since we came into this program. And my oldest son, who's 30 now, told me not too many years ago, he said, "Mama, I always knew you were crazy." And I said, "Oh." And he said, "Well, in the middle of the night, you would put us in the car. And I would say, 'Where are we going?' And you would say, 'To the grocery store.'" And he said, "I knew that you didn't even work and you stayed home all day. And why in this world you'd go to the grocery store in the middle of the night, I don't know. But see, I was going to find their daddy is where I was going. And I'd always tell them we were going to the grocery store, just lay down and go to sleep. And they would." Our youngest son, the first year of Bob's sobriety and my working this Al-Anon program, he was helping me. He was about 17 or 18, and he was helping me take down the Christmas tree. And he said, "Mom, you know, I think this is the best Christmas we've ever had." And I said, "I think so too, son. I want you to be sure and tell your daddy." He said, "Oh, I know Dad wasn't drinking, but the best part was that you weren't crying and running all through the house screaming at everybody, telling everybody what to do." So, you know, if there are any doubters that think that this disease of alcoholism is not a family disease, then you don't know what went on in my house, because my kids knew from a very early age that Daddy drank too much, and when he did, he acted funny. But what was wrong with Mother? You know, she was crazy. She really was. I took it out on them. At a young age, they began to say things like, "Mom, why are you screaming at us again? Are you mad at Daddy?" You know, they said that to me. They were very smart. Children are very perceptive, and they're very smart, and they pick up on it. But they didn't know what was wrong with me. I became suicidal because I couldn't get this man in my life to stop drinking or drink like I wanted him to. I would plan my suicide, and I was always very negative, and I thought I'd just go check in a motel and stuff towels under the door and turn the gas on, and then I'd think, well, it'd probably have electric heat, so I can't do that. And, you know, I only wanted to die for a little while anyway so that he would be sorry. I'll show him. And, you know, I planned his funeral. I used to make all of my clothes, and I every spring I had to make a nice summer dress in navy or black. And when fall came around, I had to have a black or navy wool suit so I could look nice at his funeral. And I wouldn't have had the money to put him away, and I couldn't have found six sober friends to carry him out. But I was going to look good. And that's kind of the way I lived my life. And if that's not insanity, I don't know what it is. I remember hearing the alcoholics talk about, my husband used to talk about how his mind would race. You know, he still does that to me sometimes. He'll say, "Did I tell you?" That's all he'll say. And I'll say, "What? What? No, you didn't tell me." "I don't know. I forgot what I was going to say." He's still trying to drive me crazy. I'm glad that Al-Anon teaches me how important is it, you know, that works today. But he called me on the phone one time. I was pregnant with our youngest child, and he'd been gone a couple of days, and I didn't know where he was. And the operator, it was a collect call, and the operator said, "I have a collect call for you from Fort." And before she could finish the name of the city, I had him in Fort Leavenworth prison somewhere, and he'd never know his unborn child, and what had he done now? And he was in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, is where he was. But my mind began to do things like that to me. I could figure out what he was going to do before he did it. I was totally obsessed with the drinker in my life. There was no me. Whatever mood he was in each morning, I waited to see so that I'd know how to act. I didn't tell you, but after we married, we moved around a great deal too, and he made good money, and I didn't work, and we wound up back in Memphis, and his drinking had gotten pretty bad, and he went into a treatment center, and there was an Al-Anon meeting upstairs, and they said for me that I had to go upstairs, and if they had said, "You'll have to line up now to jump off the Mississippi River Bridge," I'd have done that too. Because I thought I was supposed to do anything that they told me to do to get him sober, because he was out there, you know, wasn't he doing a good job? And I knew that I was having all these feelings. Everybody in the family was patting him on the back, and everybody out there, and "Bob, you're doing so good," and I wanted to scream, "What about me?" You know, nobody was patting me on the back. I wanted somebody to tell me that I was okay. And, you know, he was getting all the praise, and I was getting none. But I went upstairs to that Al-Anon meeting, and the only thing, that was in February of 1976. And so that was my first Al-Anon meeting, and the only thing that I remember about it was that there was a lady there who talked about all the fights, the screaming, the other women, throwing things, chasing her husband around, and I thought she'd been looking in my bedroom window at my house, because that's the way we lived. And I didn't know that anybody else lived like that. So this treatment in 76 didn't quite work, but I kept going back and forth to Al-Anon, and he was going in and out of AA. And a lot of times I only went to Al-Anon to let you know that it wasn't working. He's still drinking, and why don't you tell me what to do? I'm here. You don't understand. I'm different. But listen to me, and that's why I went to Al-Anon. A lot of times I went to Al-Anon because I would say, I'm going to a meeting. Don't you think you ought to go? And that would make him so mad. I was going to meet another man. I must have found somebody in this deal. And it was a real battle, and I went to Al-Anon to get even with him. From 76 to, I'd say 1980, somewhere along in there, I was beginning to reach a point that he was going in and out of the program and nothing seemed to work. And one time he was going to the treatment center and I said, I don't care. I don't know why not. You know, it doesn't hurt. It doesn't help. Nothing works. And I didn't know that Al-Anon was working for me, but when I was sitting in those meetings, I didn't deserve to call myself an Al-Anon, but I was still hearing what some of you were saying. Let go and let God. You can live one day at a time. Your happiness comes from within. Don't depend on someone else for your happiness. God loves you. God expects you to be happy. And I began to hear those things. And a few days when I'd be on my way to work and I didn't know where he was, I would say, well, in Al-Anon, they said I can do this one day at a time or 5 minutes at a time. And I'd try that day. And it would work. And my day would go a little bit better. And one time he was in a treatment center and hadn't worked in I don't know when. They were about to turn my utilities off. And I said, well, Al-Anon says let go and let God. And I think I did that. And our oldest boy walked in that evening and said, Mom, Dad loaned me $200 several months ago, and I figured you could use it now. I didn't even know his daddy had given him $200, and he paid it back. And I said, son, why did you think I needed it now? And he said, I don't know. I just thought you might need it. And so God worked it out, and I realized that. The first time I heard Bob tell his story in sobriety, he had me yelling, screaming, hollering, crying right up to the last drink he took, and he didn't even know when I'd attached, and that made me so mad. But today, it's all right. He sees it one way, and I see it another. But I began to detach about 2 years before his sobriety. I started to do some things for myself. I didn't carry his meals to him back in the bedroom. I didn't measure his bottle anymore, and I had long since stopped pouring it out. My mother and dad were retired, and their house was empty 3 and 4 months at a time because they traveled a lot. And at that point, I had kept it a secret, I thought, for so many years. And I could go down to their house, and I could stay anytime I wanted to. I had a key to their house. Well, I was always going to do that. But it was so far that I'd have to drive back and forth out there to cook his meals, you know, and there weren't any groceries at Mother's, and I didn't want to take the groceries from our house because he might starve. Now, he wasn't eating anyway. He was just drinking. But I never did leave. But those things kept me going, and one summer I went down to Mother's and pulled all the weeds in her flower bed. Why I didn't pull them in my own flower bed and yard, I don't know, but she had a nice flower bed that summer, and she was out of town. But that kept me busy, and then I'd go home, and he wasn't working. He was drinking every day and sometimes not even getting up out of the bed. So I didn't go home from work and go take care of him. I kept myself busy because Al-Anon told me to take care of me. And I believe that's when I started to detach. I can't promise you in our program it says to detach with love. I think I detached with indifference. I don't know. I don't know how I felt about him at that point. One night when he walked in and said he was going to a meeting with me, I said, oh, well, okay. You know, he'd been to a lot of them. And it started to work for him. And somewhere in there, maybe I let go and I got out of God's way. I don't know how this deal works. For me, when I saw him recovering, and for a while, you know, I kept track of how many meetings he went to, and we were supposed to go to a meeting on Friday night, and he worked too late, and my God, we can't make the meeting if you're going to work till 9. And I was still taking care of him, and he was getting better, and I was just the same. I couldn't figure out quite what was wrong with me, and I had to start working the steps in my life and applying this program to me. And today, I go to meetings, he goes to meetings. Sometimes we go together. Sometimes he goes to one and I don't, and I go to one and he doesn't. I shared the other night in our little Thursday night meeting how God worked for me in this little God box, and I know you've heard of it. Most of you who've been here for any length of time have. And when I got here, I was very religious. I went to church all the time, and I took those little boys to church and made sure that God saw me going in and out so that he would be good to me every time the doors were open. And, you know, that's a funny thing. One Wednesday night, my husband came home, and I was at church, and he left again, and I quit going to church on Wednesday night because he might come home. Now, 9 times out of 10, he didn't. But that one time when he came home and left, I quit going to church. That's how sick I was. But I did start a God box maybe 2 years into going to Al-Anon and him in AA in sobriety in our home, and something was still wrong with me. And I put a lot of things in there, and God answered almost every one of them, just 1, 2, 3. And the answers he gave weren't even what I could have dreamed up. This is how it's going to be. I had quit my job, and I was taking care of this little granddaughter we'd had, and she was my first little girl. My oldest boy had this little girl, and I absolutely worshipped her, and they didn't know how to take care of her anyway, so I quit my job to care for her 5 days a week. And I knew I needed to go back to work, and I didn't want anybody else to take care of her. And it was about the time that the big scandal of daycare centers was just all over the news, and my kids really didn't want her in a daycare either. But I put that in there, and I didn't have a sponsor back then, and I put that in there, and I put a lot of things in there. My old boss called me and asked me if I wanted my job back. My daughter-in-law came in and said she was pregnant again and going to quit her job and stay home and keep this one. And one day when I was at my lowest, I called Joanne, because I'd been going to meetings down there off and on. You know, I'd go to her home group, and then when she would say something I didn't like, I wouldn't go back there for a while. I'd show them. And she was telling me what I needed to hear and didn't want to hear. And I asked her to be my sponsor when I called her that day, and I did not call her with that intention. I had no intention of asking her to be my sponsor. And she said, yes, my life began to change when God showed me that he answers prayer. All of those three things happened within a 2-week period of time, and I knew that it was because I think that it was the first realization in my life that I'd had that I had truly let go of something and prayed about it and gave it to God. Somebody, was it Peg last night that talked about, I don't know how grown-ups pray? I don't know how grown-ups pray either. And when I write things down to God, I just write to him like he was my best friend, which he is. Dear God, this is what's troubling me today. This is what I can't handle. I don't know how anybody else works a God box, but I have to talk to him just like he's on my level. And that's what I did then. And those things happened to me and really changed my life. My sponsor's big on service work. She's the one, the first time I was asked to speak and share with this little Al-Anon group, I said, well, I can't do that. I've never done that. She said, yes, you can. It's not you anyway, it's God. All you do is just ask God to take over. It's easy. And she encouraged me in every area. And she took me when I was totally unlovable, mixed up and confused, critical of everything in the Al-Anon Fellowship. And she encouraged me, that's all right. You know, that's okay. Keep coming back. You'll be okay. I did get involved in service work by first being GR, for group representative for my home group, and then district representative, which I'm serving out the last year of that right now. I am still active at my home group. And my home group is Traditions in Memphis. And if you're ever there, we meet on Monday and Friday nights, and it's the best group in the whole wide world. And if you don't think yours is, you better go find you another one. And we're getting ready to have our Christmas party in conjunction with the AA's Traditions group is a big family group, and we do a lot of things together. We're going to have an 18-year anniversary celebration in January. We have speakers coming from California, and we've just been working and raffling off cakes and doing all these things all year to get ready for that. And I'm chairman of the Christmas party this year, and that's a real special time. We all get together down there, and everybody gets up to share a little bit. And it just feels like a real family thing when we have our Christmas party there at Traditions. But I can call myself an active member of Al-Anon today because I go to my group meetings, I serve there as treasurer, I steal empty ashtrays and the garbage cans sometimes. I think some of those girls think the AAs or the little fairy is going to come in at night and empty that garbage can because it just is terrible. And when I start to gather up things and empty that garbage can, then two or three of them will help me. But I still do things like that because it makes me feel like I'm a part of that group, and I think that I need to keep on doing that. And the program has meant so much to me. We have 9 grandchildren today. If anybody would like to see some pictures after the meeting, I have a few. We had one born the last of October and one in August. That made 9. Bob's oldest son, that was 4 for him. And Bob's stepfather was a wonderful, wonderful man before he passed away. He was probably one of our biggest enablers. He did everything under the sun for us. He was Bob's stepfather for almost 40 years, I guess, and his name was Morgan. So this newest grandchild that was born, Bob's son named him Morgan. And he said he's going to call him Mo. And Bob said, well, I think you better call him No Mo. But those kids got together and gave us 6 of those grandkids in about 6 months' time. And we went over to Baptist East Hospital so many times, they would say, oh, well, we've seen you all here before. And just having 4 children, you wouldn't think that we'd be that busy, but we have been. We can enjoy those kids today. And every one of them have had their problems. We don't have any of them. At one point, after I was so gung-ho Al-Anon, I tried my hardest to get my oldest son in AA. He belonged here, and I knew it, and I was going to let him know how to take care of his problem. He drinks today, but if it gives him a problem in his daily life with his job, his family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, he's still handling it well. The youngest one needed Al-Anon so bad. He would still be taking care of his daddy if his daddy was still drinking. He used to get mad at me. Bob's mother and I were in the kitchen one day, and he went out in the car and left just as drunk as he could be and had a wreck. Drove back home, and when that boy came in, he was mad at us. He said, why did you let my daddy drive? He might have killed himself. So I knew he needed Al-Anon a long time ago. He wouldn't let me mow the yard because he was afraid the neighbors might think he was lazy. He would say, Mom, the neighbors know you've got a son living at home. You better not be out there mowing the yard. But that was one of my therapy things when I was trying to let go of Bob, was to get out there and try to mow that yard. And that kid wouldn't hardly let me. Son, I need to do this. And he would say, no, the neighbors will think I'm lazy. But those kids, for growing up in active alcoholism, have turned out rather well. I'm very proud of them. They've all had their problems. And do you know that because of AA and Al-Anon in our lives, when they have problems, who do you think they come to? They come to their daddy and I. And that gives me cold chills because I can remember when they wouldn't have come and asked our advice for anything in the whole wide world, and they wouldn't have allowed their children over there. Pappy wouldn't have been quite the man that he is today if he had not found sobriety in this program. And I'm not sure those kids could stand to come over to a house where there was a lot of screaming and hollering and crying going on all the time. And I'm not sure that I could have the patience that I have with them today and enjoy them like I do, had it not been for Al-Anon. I just sometimes remember an Al-Anon speaker that I heard. She said she couldn't stand these little prim and proper Al-Anons that come up here and say, well, my husband got sober and now he owns his own company and my daughter's a cheerleader and my son plays football and everything's wonderful. Well, I'm here to tell you that's not the way our life's been. We've had a lot of things happen to us since sobriety. And without the friends in this program, we never had friends like that. We've had a lot of deaths in our immediate family. My father, Bob's stepfather, his grandmother, his mother's had some serious illnesses and bad problems. She stayed with us for 6 months last year. And Bob's had cancer 3 times. And without this program, I remember the night that I took him down to the hospital. It was almost like an outpatient surgery, but back then they were going to check him in that night and do the surgery the next morning. And he said, you might as well go on home. I'm just going to be laying here. I'll see you in the morning. And I went home, and it was so different from when I poured him in before. You know, when I admit him to the hospital, I'd go home just delighted that I knew where he was. And this time I did go home, but this friends of ours in the program called, and I told him how I felt. And it was like 11 or 12 o'clock at night. It was cold as it could be, and it was raining. And they said, do you want to go back down there? We'll come get you and take you back down there. And it was all the way downtown in Memphis. And I said, no, I don't want you to do that. And they said, if you wake up, no matter what time of the night it is, and you want to go back down there at that hospital, you call us and we'll take you down there. So I made it through the night, and I went down there the next morning with him. But I didn't know friends. And, you know, my family members, I would expect to do that if I called my mother or my brother and said, come get me in the middle of the night. But I didn't know that friends would do that. I found that here in this program. When my daddy was dying with cancer, he was in a coma, and 5 different times they called the whole family to the hospital, and we stayed the whole night because they didn't think he would live through the night. And every time I'd go up there, I would look up, and here would be my sponsor and 2 or 3 other girls coming with a big thermos of coffee and cups and cream and sugar, and they'd sit up there with us and stay. And the night my father passed away, the first people who walked through my mother's front door were all the program people that were at our Christmas party that night. He died December the 17th, and it was our Christmas party at our group that night, so everybody knew about it. And my mother still marvels at all the people and the flowers and the things. She said, those people didn't even know your daddy. And I said, no, they didn't, Mother, but they did it for us to show their respect and because they love us. I can never begin to repay this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, first of all, for giving me a husband that I dreamed about having and never thought it was possible. And for giving out the Al-Anon program, the 12 steps which we have. And I thank Al-Anon and all my friends in Al-Anon who put up with me, who stood beside me, who listened to me with all those but ifs. But you don't understand, but I'm different. This won't work for me. I know today that if my husband drinks again tomorrow, that I never have to go back to being the lonely, frustrated, suicidal person that I was when I got here. I don't have to. I have choices today. I would be able to choose whether I stayed or whether I left. I didn't know I had choices until I came into this Al-Anon program. I believe that God meant for me to be happy. And for some reason, being born in the Ozark Mountains, I feel closer to God on top of a mountain. And I know I can take him with me anywhere I go. but it just feels great to be on a mountaintop. Yesterday we drove into Chattanooga and we enjoyed it so much, and the mountains are absolutely gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. This has been a real special weekend, and I want to thank you so much for inviting us here. And I can only remember the closing of the Al-Anon thing that I love so much. It says, talk to each other, reason things out, but let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of this program grow in you one day at a time. I love you all, and I thank you so much.